Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1066, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, part 6. This is being recorded on March 26th of the year 2019. I'm going to go just plunge right into the limitations of time. We've been talking about the right wing and in many cases fascist inclinations, affiliations of many of the people that are associated with the left-wing, quote, socialists, unquote, people like St. Bernard, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is the sixth hour, and there will be at least one more after this. So I'm not going to dally in this. When I get all of these recorded, all of the audio tracks will be embedded in a long written description, which will permit people to peruse much of this at greater length, including information about the opportunity zones as demarcated by the GOP in their tax bill that is going to be a major propaganda pillar of the 2020 campaign. And I think that the AOC and her opposition to the Amazon deal, which had a big downside on the balance, I think it would have been good if, and again, that's a very big if, it could have been successfully negotiated. One wonders about Jeff Bezos on the other side, with a grandfather who was one of the founders of DARPA, having got his start in business with a $300,000 investment from his father, who came over here courtesy of a CIA program designed in considerable measure by Antonio Veciana and Maurice Bishop, a.k.a. David Attlee Phillips, whom both of whom we looked at some length in our series with Jim DiGiamio. One wonders if perhaps there is a CIA presence on both sides. Entirely speculative here. Now, something I mentioned at the beginning of the program, our last show, another thing that makes me more than a little suspicious is that one of the major financial angels behind the left wing of the Democratic Party and the likes of Bernie and AOC, I don't know that she has actually contributed to their political gravitas, but she is in that milieu, my favorite word, is none other than a woman named Leah Hunt Hendricks. She is the granddaughter of H.L. Hunt. We are told that she has undergone something of a, I don't know if Damascus Road conversion would be the proper word, but that she no longer believes in the values of the Hunt family, but now she has seen the errors of her way, her family's ways, understands the evil that great capital can precipitate, and wants to further the cause of humanity, just like Silicon Valley and Wall Street multimillionaire Sekat Subhash Chandra Bose Chakrabarty, the guy behind AOC. I mean, that blows my mind. More about Subhash Chandra Bose in this program. But of Leah Hunt Hendricks, granddaughter of H.L. Hunt, and one of the financial angels behind the so-called progressive sector. And simply put, I don't believe it. I don't believe she's undergone a conversion. I think she is operating in the same context that we have seen for a long time, going back at least to 1968, when Stuart Mott, a fellow who became wealthy as a result of his family's major investment in General Motors stock and their Mott fruit juice and apple products empire, applesauce, apple juice, a guy named Stuart Mott helped to finance Eugene McCarthy's 1968 campaign. Eugene McCarthy identified as a CIA officer in the book Who's Who in the CIA, which has stayed a source as Jack Anderson viewed, the late syndicated columnist Jack Anderson viewed as authoritative of that book, identified Eugene McCarthy, who backed Ronald Reagan, by the way, in 1980, as CIA. At the same time that Stuart Mott was financing the, quote, peace unquote, candidate Eugene McCarthy of the CIA. He also was financing an organization called Environmental Industries Incorporated, as revealed by Jim Hogan in his book Spooks. Sounds really green and wonderful, a Green New Deal. The New Deal, all right, but it was not green. The idea, it was the parent company for Mitchell Werbel's silenced machine gun manufacturing. Mitchell Werbel, another person we spoke about in connection with Bernardo de Torres and Gordon Novell in our interviews with Jim DiGiamio, known as the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons or the Wizard of Whispering Death. Mitch Werbel had a long-standing relationship to the CIA, and Environmental Industries Incorporated was the parent company for the manufacture of his Ingram MAC-10 and MAC-11 machine pistols. It was a grim pun. The idea was that they had a contribution to make to population control. I strongly suspect that Leah Hunt Hendricks is operating in a similar context to Stuart Mott, who then, by the way, went on to bankroll George McGovern, who got beaten like a gong in the 1972 election, won one state out of 50. Of Leah Hunt Hendricks and her founding of the Solid Bear Network and a bit about her background. August 24th, 2017, San Francisco Magazine at modernluxury.com. So you find all these socialists. Cash, Speed, and Trust by Lauren Smiley. For the Solid Bear Network and its founder, a 34-year-old oil heiress and newcomer to San Francisco named Leah Hunt Hendricks, the Krasner primary proved that relatively small amounts of money can have a big impact if given to an on-the-ground organization with deep local ties. It goes on to talk about some of the other wealthy people, including the heirs to Silicon Valley, big money, who are behind her. And it mentions that she is the granddaughter of H.L. Hunt. In an op-ed published in February by Politico, Hunt Hendricks criticized the Democratic establishment for its caution and fealty to moneyed interests. I mean, it's just beautiful. This from H.L. Hunt's granddaughter. Solid Bear doesn't just want Democratic wins. Hunt Hendricks says it wants systemic change, unquote. A radical restructuring of the economic system that Solid Bear's members have so richly benefited from. About her background, skip me now. Hunt Hendricks set off to study politics at Duke and then went on to a PhD program at Princeton, where Cornel West was one of her advisors. Studying in the Middle East during grad school, Hunt Hendricks was invigorated by the weekly Palestinian protests of the West Bank Wall from 2006 to 2009. That's when she changed, Hunt recalls. That's when Leah saw what could happen when people rose up. Well, the whole Palestinian situation is more complex, and we haven't got time to go into it. It has become, the cause of the Palestinians has become a cause célèbre among a lot of young people. One of the factors behind the elevation of the Palestinians and the whole Israeli-Palestinian situation is incalculably more complex than it has been made out to be. And interestingly enough, it goes back to the colonial period when decisive elements, in particular in the Palestinian movement, and also in the right wing of the Israeli political establishment and the Zionist movement, forged operational links with fascism. The Palestinian cause is almost inextricably linked with Haj Amin al-Husseini and people like Otto Skorzeny. I've spoken about that at length in the past. More about that later. And the something else I'm going to have to update is the fascist element in the Zionist movement, which is ascendant in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, was the personal secretary to Vladimir Yabotinsky, who was an outright fascist, although his apologists will not admit that. He was an admirer of Mussolini. His cadre trained with Mussolini. They supported Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which they saw as an assertion of the superiority of white people over non-white people. Yabotinsky did not feel that workers in the coming Zionist country should be allowed to strike. And perhaps most revealingly, he allied himself with Simon Petliura, a pogromist butcher in Ukraine, revered now by the OUNB successor organizations. And Petro Poroshenko was feted by Benjamin Netanyahu on a recent visit to Israel. The Likud party sent a representative to the National Congress of the Alianza Nazionale, the successor to Mussolini's fascistis in the late 1990s, and Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet advisory positions, many of them have ties to ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. More about that later. Benjamin Netanyahu himself was a major investor in ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems, have something like $1.5 million in stock. ThyssenKrupp, one of the pillars of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. We will go into that at a future date when I update Bormann Jews and the fascist element in the Zionist movement. Suffice it to say, however, we're going to come back ever so briefly to Haji Amin al-Husseini. He was one of the people with whom Subhas Chandra Bose helped to network, and Subhas Chandra Bose also supported Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which he saw as an assertion of Aryan supremacy, unquote. Subhas Chandra Bose's ideology has undergone a lot of political revisionism over the decades. I find it very interesting that Hunt Hendricks sort of had her Damascus Road conversion in connection with the Palestinian situation. We will at a future time review information and more fully develop information that we first presented in For the Record 538. One of the major features of global Muslim Brotherhood ideological presentation and propagation is to take the Palestinian issue and use it as a political cudgel, as a lever to basically not only install them in power, but ultimately as a vehicle for anti-Israeli activity, and I would say anti-Zionism. One of the ironies in so many young people joining or associating themselves with the BDS movement and so forth is not only do they not know about the very complex history of the whole Israeli-Palestinian situation, which, like the situation in India, goes back to the colonial period and involves the alliance between the fascist powers of Europe and some of the anti-British colonial elements like the aforementioned Vladimir Yabotinsky and also like Haji Amin al-Husseini. The Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization that is viewed by great favor with the very neoliberal institutions that many of these BDS-affiliated young people castigate. The World Bank, we've talked about this in the past, the World Bank views Ibn Khaldun, that's IBM, last name Khaldun, as the first advocate of privatization. Ibn Khaldun is the number one economic theorist revered by the Muslim Brotherhood and by the World Bank. And in its support for the Muslim Brotherhood, the international corporate community is basically looking to institutionalize corporatist economics in the Arab and Muslim worlds. The Palestinian issue is one of the vehicles, one of the major elements of the program that has been formulated by the Muslim Brotherhood to realize what is ultimately a globalist agenda. I also note that one of Leah Hunt Hendricks' advisors was none other than Cornel West. He also was a major advisor to Bernie Sanders. I remember a statement he made after the Democratic Convention in 2016. He said, basically, we have to vote for Jill Stein and the Green Party because we didn't get everything we want, meaning the Bernie Sanders people didn't get everything they wanted at the Democratic Convention. Well, you never get everything you want in life, period, particularly not in politics. And to storm off like an adolescent and say, well, we need to vote for Jill Stein. I hope Cornel West is really, really happy with what Trump and company are doing. And I hope he has a really good time watching the policies being implemented by the Supreme Court that Donald Trump is going to be able to dominate. I have never seen anything concrete about Cornel West being affiliated with the intelligence community. But in tribal societies, they looked up to the elders because the elders had seen things and experienced things and lived through things that young people, through no fault of their own, did not see or experience and could not understand past a point. Watching Bernie Sanders and the likes of Cornel West, it was like that 60s show. You know, I've seen this all before. And if there are a way of verifying it, and there isn't, if, again, with a capital I and a capital F, I would bet a large sum of money that Cornel West has links to the intel community. He just, the way he talks, the things he says and does, again, it's that 60s show, just a standard FBI and or CIA-controlled agent provocateur, jive N-word. I've seen so many of them. And again, I've never seen anything concrete about such connections for Cornel West, but his rhetoric, even the tone of his voice, just has that 60s show to me. And watching Cornel West as an influence on Leah Hunt Hendricks doesn't surprise me one bit. Leah Hunt Hendricks' mother, along with her father, operates something of a, I think a cult is a fair way of putting it. They take couples whose marriages are on the rocks and get them to stay together. They've had a lot of exposure on Oprah, who has some of the very worst New Age and cultist stuff on her program. I would note the following from the Pacific Standard blog of March 16th of 2015 by Jessica Weisberg. The man who wants to save your marriage. It's about Leah Hunt Hendricks' parents. LaKelly Hunt, that's her mother, who was inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame for her philanthropic work, counts the feminist Gloria Steinem among her closest friends. And in the article from San Francisco Magazine, it also talks about Leah Hunt Hendricks' close connections to Gloria Steinem. So I wonder, is this, in fact, another point of CIA influence? Because I don't think that Steinem's involvement with CIA ended in the 1960s. Again, there's a miscellaneous archive show which has now been transcribed into the news and supplemental section called Gloria in Excelsis, which contains my ruminations in that regard. By the way, shared by a great many other people. All things considered, I just do not buy the notion that Leah Hunt Hendricks has undergone something of a political conversion. She's no longer part of the Hunt family, Paleolithic political agenda. Nope, she's got religion. I don't buy it. I think she is operating in a similar fashion to Stuart Mott, who was financing Eugene McCarthy at the same time that he's financing Mitchell Werbel. Now, coming back to the issue of Subhas Chandra Bose. Subhas Chandra Bose, again, worked with the Axis. He was an Indian nationalist We were at one point allied with Mahatma Gandhi, but Subhas Chandra Bose believed very firmly in armed struggle. And ultimately, he and Gandhi not just fell out, but Gandhi came to despise Subhas Chandra Bose, as I had noted in For the Record 988 and 989, the RSS with which Tulsi Gabbard is affiliated, and that is the Hindutva Fascist Party, that is the generating organization of the BJP and Narendra Modi. They murdered Mahatma Gandhi. The aforementioned Subhas Chandra Bose networked not only with Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. His European combatant force was ultimately absorbed into the Waffen-SS. He also networked with Karl Haushofer, who had a relatively complex political outlook. He was, however, a major influence on Hitler. Good discussion of Karl Haushofer in the aforementioned Dreamer of the Day, Francis Patriarchy and the Post-War Fascist International by Kevin Coogan. But I want to talk about Subhas Chandra Bose because, A, he not only linked to Karl Haushofer, but he had links to the Japanese Black Dragon Society. That was the most important of the patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies. It was a clandestine organization that was one of the driving forces behind Japanese aggression and had very strong links to Japanese intelligence. He also, as we will see, had very strong links to German intelligence as well. He worked with Admiral Canaris of the Abwehr. He networked with the Grand Mufti, like Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Benjamin Netanyahu was the personal secretary to. That is Benjamin Netanyahu's father and political mentor. Like Vladimir Jabotinsky, Subhas Chandra Bose saw Mussolini's invasion of Italy as an affirmation of the superiority of European or, quote, Aryan, unquote, peoples over the darker skinned peoples of the world. Subhas Chandra Bose also networked with the Grand Mufti, and we're going to look at that. We're going back now many years into the archives. We're going to go back to For the Retro Anti-Fascist Archives show number 7 about fascist mind control cults. This was recorded in the late fall of 1984, so we're going back about almost 36 years into the archives. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my brilliant and very charming former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose brilliance and intellect and charm were absolutely fundamental to the successful execution of the archive shows, and we are all indebted to him for that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
The books from which you will hear reading are Kempe Tai by Richard Beacon, subtitled The Japanese Secret Service Then and Now by Richard Beacon, and also Spies and Traitors of World War II by Kurt Singer, K-U-R-T, Singer, S-I-N-G-E-R, published by Prentice Hall in 1945. And again, going back to AFA number 7, we're going to hear more about Subhas Chandra Bose. The key here is to understand not only that Subhas Chandra Bose was working with the Axis, that he mustered some 90,000 combatants on behalf of the Axis, that he worked with intelligence services of Japan and Germany, including clandestine elements, because as we will see, the official story of Subhas Chandra Bose's death in the plane crash in August of 1945 has come into question, and there have been a number of substantive observers who have opined that, in fact, he did not die in that plane crash, but used that as a vehicle for going underground in order to continue his political work underground. That might very well bring him into not only the context of Cold War policy. We'll talk about that more. But also, I think there is a very reasonable question to ask about a post-war Bozist or Bozian political underground, perhaps to be used as anti-communist and post-fascist. Although, like many nationalist leaders who allied with fascism, Subhas Chandra Bose was to an extent practicing realpolitik. He believed in armed struggle and was also enamored of many aspects of the fascist system. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes, came to see Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia as the affirmation of, quote, Aryans, unquote, over darker skinned peoples. Once Subhas Chandra Bose made his commitment to the Axis, he would have been bound on the wheel. And if, in fact, he went underground, and we're going to talk about that, there are substantive indications that that may have been the case, it would have been to continue his political work, very possibly on behalf of underground Japanese fascists who were being rehabilitated, as we have looked at in many shows, and that were put basically right back in power, as we have seen in many programs, including our discussions with Sperling and Peggy Seagraves about the book Gold Warriors. It would have placed him in connection with elements of German intelligence and quite possibly CIA and or MI6, British overseas intelligence. But again, going back to late 1984 from AFA program number 7 about fascist mind control cults, talking about Subhas Chandra Bose from Kemp Etar by Richard Deacon and Spies and Traitors of World War II by Kurt Singer, and talk about Subhas Chandra Bose's links to Mitsuo Toyama and the Japanese Black Dragon Society, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris of the Abwehr, Joseph Goebbels, the Grand Mufti, his views on Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. Very, very significant indeed.
I'd like to go back for just a second to the book that Nip Talk read you a short section of a while ago. The book is called Kempe Tai, K-E-M-P-E-I, T-A-I is the second word, subtitled A History of the Japanese Secret Service, authored by Richard Deacon. Now, in here, Richard Deacon goes back to the most, is going to talk about, I should say, the most important of the Japanese patriotic societies that paved the way for fascism in Japan and World War II. The most important of all of those societies was called the Black Dragon Society. That organization derived its name from the Amur River, which provides the borderline between Russia, or now the Soviet Union, and China. Amur, I believe, means black dragon in Chinese. Now, the Black Dragon Society had served as a vehicle for Japanese espionage against Russia even before it became the Soviet Union, and then after the Bolshevik Revolution, it continued to function in the same fashion and was the major organ of Japanese espionage against the Soviet Union. It also was the single most important of the Japanese patriotic societies, and, its influence in the rise of fascism to Japan could not be overemphasized. The two names that we want to know here are a guy named Roi Yoshida. He was the head of the Black Dragon Society when it was working towards World War II, and also a fellow named Mitsuru Toyama, last name T-O-Y-A-M-A. Mitsuru Toyama, or Mitsuri Toyama, as he's referred to here, founded the Black Dragon Society and remained its sort of patron throughout, even when Yoshida took over the active functioning of it. And it's worth noting that the Black Dragon Society was directly connected to the German Nazi Party through a fellow named Don Gatto, who was a Nazi press correspondent in Tokyo. Anyway, in Kempe Tai, Richard Deacon writes of the Black Dragon Society as follows. The Black Dragon Society increased numerically in all-around strength and in political influence in the 1920s and 30s. Dominated by Roi Yoshida, the society laid down its policy as follows. Quote, we shall renovate the present system, foster a foreign policy aiming at expansion overseas, revolutionize domestic policies to increase the happiness of the people, and establish a social policy that will settle problems between labor and capital. And a little farther down, he writes, the Black Dragon Society was in many respects empirical, that's E-M-P-I-R-I-C-A-L, in outlook as well as chauvinistic. It was just as interested in left-wing revolutionaries as in right-wing reactionaries or muddle-headed liberals, if any of these could be exploited to aid the cause of Japanese expansion. An Indian terrorist who had long campaigned against the British, Rash Bahari Bose, last name B-O-S-E, fled to Japan in 1915 and was befriended by Mitsuru Toyama. Recall, Toyama was the founder and patron of the Black Dragon Society, the single most important individual affiliated with it. Continuing, the latter not only helped Bose to become a Japanese citizen, but adopted him into his family when Bose married one of Toyama's followers. The ex-Indian terrorist became an agent for the Japanese and helped to found the Pan-Asiatic League. This movement was closely linked with the Black Dragon and the Great East Asian Co-Prosperity Project. In all these, Bose played a considerable role. However, Bose was obviously too old for all the work involved in these organizations, and though he worked for the Japanese from Bangkok during World War II, he was eventually succeeded by his namesake, Subhas Chandra Bose, another anti-British Indian the Japanese lured away from Berlin. A similar anti-colonial pro-Japanese body created by the Japanese was the Aryan Army, headed by Raja Mahendra Pratap, P-R-A-T-A-P. This was ultimately taken over by the Indian Independence League of East Asia, which was another of Rash Bahari Bose's brainchildren. The latter died early in 1945. So these two Bose Indian nationalists, or ultra-nationalists, fascists actually, as we're going to see in just a couple of minutes, are affiliated with the Black Dragon Society. First we have Rash Bahari Bose, who flees to Japan after working against the British, is practically adopted by Mitsuru Toyama, who provides him with a wife. He then goes to work with the Black Dragon Society and Japanese intelligence, preparing for World War II, works for Japan in Bangkok during World War II, and his activities on the Indian subcontinent are basically adopted or co-opted by his successor named Subhas Chandra Bose. That name, S-U-B-H-A-S-C-H-A-N-D-R-A, last name B-O-S-E. So recall the two Boses, Rash Bahari and Subhas Chandra Bose, both Indian ultra-nationalists who sought help from fascist Japan in their struggle against the British. And recall, again, their links to the Black Dragon Society, the most important of the patriotic societies, and we've already looked at their connections to the Moonies.
And as we'll see later, the Bose connections extend not only to Japan, but to other places too, and we'll follow up on that.
We're going to read you now from a book called Spies and Traitors of World War II. That was authored by a man named Kurt Singer, S-I-N-G-E-R, and it's copyrighted in 1945. It's hardcover edition by Prentice Hall, Incorporated. Okay, so this is right after the end of World War II. Of Subhas Chandra Bose, Singer writes as follows in Spies and Traitors of World War II. History has shown that a strong people can afford to be merciful even to its direst enemies. Bose was beyond doubt an incorrigible. In 1934 and 5, he was busy in Berlin, Vienna, and Rome. He met Hitler and Mussolini. He listened carefully and proceeded with the utmost caution, but he followed in the footsteps of his master and wrote his Mein Kampf, which he entitled India's Struggle. He expressed hearty approval of Mussolini's carnage in Ethiopia. He made Indians who volunteered to fight with Emperor Haile Selassie's troops the butt of furious vituperation. As a climax to his European jaunt, he founded the German Indian Society. One of the honorary directors of the new club was none other than Admiral Walter Wilhelm Canaris. Canaris, by the way, was the head of the Abwehr, German military intelligence at that time. That's an interjection. Continuing with the text, Bose was granted a long interview with that gentleman, who expressed his warm friendliness toward Bose's dream of an independent India. In Berlin, Bose altered many of his ideas. He had completely dropped his pro-Russian feelings. Now he became race-conscious. A stately figure in his Oriental robes, he went on conducted tours through Berlin. His guide was an attractive maiden of the Hitler Youth named Ingeborg. She showed him the later bombed-out Pergamon Museum, the Staatsoper, the Potsdam Drive. They conversed on the Nazi theory of the superiority of the Aryan race. India, after all, was the cradle of the Aryan race. Bose was well pleased with this idea. India rightly belonged to the Aryan Axis group of nations. It was a new slogan and would speed the struggle for freedom. Of course, the Nordic maiden who introduced him to the idea had received instructions from Canaris on the topics on which to touch. But that scarcely mattered. The Nazis put him on the air. Bose addressed the Orient from radio stations in Zeissen and Königswusterhausen. He roundly condemned Great Britain and announced the formation of the Aryan Axis. he extended friendship to Japan. And so again, we have connections here between Subhas Chandra Bose with Hitler and Mussolini with the Abwehr, all of this before World War II. He's conducting propaganda broadcasts now on behalf of the Third Reich. Recall the Ananda Marga symbol with the rising sun of Japan and the Nazi swastika.
Going on, then in 1939, the war started. Bose promptly made a journey to Berlin, where he met Goebbels and the Grand Mufti again. We'll talk about the Grand Mufti some more in a moment. His next steps were dictated by the Canaris office. He was to fight against British control in India and against the influence of Gandhi. You remember, of course, the reference earlier in the broadcast to their opposition to principles of nonviolence. And, of course, Gandhi was the leading advocate of nonviolence in the Indian struggle for independence.
Worth noting that initially Subhas Chandra Bose was an ally and follower of Gandhi's, but he broke with Gandhi specifically over the question of violence.
Gandhi, the great prophet, emphasized that he had no grievances against the British people, but only against their government. He ardently opposed Japan's designs on India and warned Japan that she was not to think of profiting from a British defeat. But Bose harangued his followers in another vein. Quote, "The Axis will give us independence. Let us join with Japan in chasing the British out of India." In 1943, Bose met dictator Hideki Tojo in Tokyo. A Japanese submarine then brought him to the site of Britain's most humiliating defeat, Singapore. Bose recruited his army, raised the flag of Free India. He concluded alliances with other Quislings in Thailand and Burma. On to Delhi was still his slogan. He referred to himself as the savior of India. Quote, "I, your leader, have millions of pounds of rice ready to be shipped to famine-stricken India, but the British, our implacable and pitiless enemies, have stopped the shipment. They would rather let you starve than accept the succor which is contributed by our friends and allies in Japan." Bose spoke long and loud. He circulated incendiary pamphlets, but all in vain. Traitors are despised by their fellow countrymen. Gandhi earnestly warned against his hypocrisy, and Gandhi's warning was heeded. In Bose's person, the Japanese and German secret services were given the cold shoulder. And there's a footnote that mentions Bose died suddenly in 1945 and never saw the end of the war. This is significant for a variety of reasons. Most significant the fact that he shared lodgings with Sarkar, and that he obviously was still in the flush of his fascist period when he was in contact with Sarkar, since he never got a chance to be rehabilitated, as so many of our other fascist friends seem to be.
Well, again, the point can't be stressed too strongly that Bose was an Axis intelligence agent when Sarkar was living with him. Ask yourself whether an intelligence agent would have somebody living with him and presumably having access to his activities, whom he either didn't trust, or ask if he would even have a neutral person living with him. So again, when Sarkar is living with Subhas Chandra Bose, Bose is fraternizing and working on behalf of the likes of Hitler, Goebbels, and so forth. And also, it's worth noting, I think, that the Nazis were very skillful in utilizing nationalist sentiments, in particular nationalists, many of them quite sincere, at least to begin with, in many of the areas of the various empires that existed at that time, Britain in particular. There's a reference here to a fellow named the Grand Mufti. That fellow's name is Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims. He also was a major in the SS, and we've taken a look at connections between some of his followers and the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and specifically the involvement of the son of one of his top followers in the 1972 Olympics massacre in Munich, Germany. So, again, we have these threads which are continuous to this day.
That, again, from AFA program number 7, recorded in very late 1984, available, by the way, in the Anti-Fascist Archives show, a section, I should say, category of the SpitfireList.com website, about Subhas Chandra Bose and his intelligence networking both with Japanese fascism and the Black Dragon Society and Mitsuru Toyama, and also Admiral Canaris, Joseph Goebbels, the Grand Mufti, and similar elements as well. The point being that not only was Subhas Chandra, not only did he have his fingers in really deep, but he was very powerfully connected to clandestine elements, both of the Nazi and Japanese intelligence and power political structures. At the end of the war, he would not have been able to just go back to India above ground. The British would have certainly arrested him, tried him for war crimes. Very possibly he would have been assassinated by MI6. There are indications that, in fact, Subhas Chandra Bose did not die, but went underground. In the History Today blog, Volume 60, Issue 11, there is an article by Hugh, H-U-G-H, Purcell, P-U-R-C-E-L-L, Subhas Chandra Bose, The Afterlife of India's Fascist Leader. On September 16, 1985, in a dilapidated house in Faizabad, formerly the capital of Udh, O-U-D-H province in India, a reclusive holy man known as Bhagwanji or Gumnami Baba, B-A-B-A, the saint with no name, breathed his last. Locals had long suspected that he was none other than Subhas Chandra Bose, the Indian quasi-fascist leader who in the 1930s had advocated a violent revolution against the British Empire to gain total independence for India. The Second World War had enabled him to practice what he preached, and his Indian National Army had fought with the Japanese in Burma, attempting to drive the British out of the subcontinent. As we've seen, he also had links in Europe to the Nazis, Hitler, and the Waffen-SS. Continuing. Although Netaji, that's N-E-T-A-J-I, great leader Bose, was reported killed in an air crash in August of 1945, many believed then and continue to believe now that, helped by his Japanese allies, he faked his death and returned to India many years later to lead the secret life of a hermit. Surprisingly, for a poor sadhu, as S-A-D-H-U, or mystic, the saint with no name left behind many trunks of possessions, and in 1986, realizing that these might solve the mystery of his death once and for all, Bose's niece, Lalita, obtained a high court order for an inventory to be made of their contents. Among the 2,673 items indexed, Lalita claimed she saw letters in her uncle's handwriting and family photographs. Gumnami Baba's belongings were repacked in 23 boxes and sent to the district treasury. Very unusual behavior for a poor Hindu mystic. Continuing and skipping down. In his inquiry report completed in 2006, Justice Mukherjee was categorical. That's capital M-U-K-H-E-R-J-E-E, was categoric. Mukherjee concluded, quote, Netaji Bose is dead. Apparently a safe bet, as he would have been 109. He did not die in the plane crash as alleged, and the ashes in the Japanese temple in Tokyo maintained by the Indian government since 1945 are not of Netaji. One more time, the Justice Mukherjee, who looked into the affairs of Gumnami Baba or Bhagwanji Baba. Netaji Bose is dead, but he did not die in the plane crash as alleged, and the ashes in the Japanese temple in Tokyo, as maintained by the Indian government since 1945, are not of Netaji Bose. He was more narrowly legalistic about the Faizabad connection. In the absence of any clinching evidence to prove that the Bhagwani Gumnami Baba was Netaji, the question whether he died in Faizabad on September 16, 1985, as testified by some of the witnesses, need not be answered. Point is, he's not saying that no, that was not Netaji Bose. He's saying it need not be answered. In other words, the question is not important to answer because, and this is the Indian magistrate who looked into his death, he did not die, quoting again, he did not die in the plane crash as alleged, and the ashes in the Japanese temple in Tokyo are not of Netaji. Skipping down. Nevertheless, caught off guard in a TV interview in January of 2010, Mukherjee can clearly be heard saying that he thinks that Bhagwanji and Bose may well be the same person. When the story of Bose's death in 1945 reached British Viceroy Wavell, W-A-V-E-L-L, he said, quote, "I suspect it very much," meaning he is suspicious of it. "It is just what should be given out if he meant to go underground," unquote. In 1946, Gandhi claimed that inner voices were telling him, quote, "Subhas is still alive and biding his time somewhere." And skipping down again, talking about his broadcasts to the Allies from Berlin, as we heard in the material from Spies and Traitors of World War II by Kurt Singer. Soon Britons and Indians could hear his propaganda broadcasts, stirring up revolt against the British Empire and boasting about his Indian Legion, a body of soldiers trained by and intended to fight alongside the German Wehrmacht. In 1943, discouraged by Hitler's lackluster support for Indian independence and aware that the theater of war where he needed to pit his troops was now the Far East, he traveled halfway round the world underwater by first German and then Japanese submarine to Japan. Admired there, meaning in Japan, he received official support and set up his 50,000-strong Azad Hind Fauj, or Indian National Army, recruited largely from Indian soldiers of the British Empire Army who had been captured by the Japanese in their successful offensive of 1942. That, by the way, would certainly have included many members of the Hindu Mahasabha, or Hindu Mahasabha, one of the RSS-affiliated organizations that sought Indian participation in British military formations to give them military training, and they were, or the Hindu Mahasabha, that is, were open admirers of the Nazis and their persecution of Jews. Point being that with a 50,000-strong army in Asia, some accounts put that at 90,000, there would have been cause for the forces that were coalescing for the Cold War to have turned to Subhas Chandra Bose in order to use his combatants and his leadership skills in the coming Cold War. We'll talk more about that in our next show. We're going to take a look not only at other things that were going on in the Pacific theater of war during World War II, in the immediate, and I mean immediate, aftermath of VJ Day, or even before. We're going to look at something that isn't, events that are not in and of themselves directly relevant to Subhas Chandra Bose and his very possible going underground, but they are certainly historically, contextually linked to that.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Something else that we are going to explore is a cult called the Ananda Marga cult. It was founded by a guy named Sarkar, and it is ostensibly a spiritually transcendental organization. And for many members, it may be just that. They specialize in teaching yoga. Mr. Sarkar, however, was a nephew of, and at one point a co-resident or roommate, if you will, of Subhas Chandra Bose. Now, since Subhas Chandra Bose officially died in 1945, Sarkar would have been living with him when he was working for the Axis. And it would have been, it is more than a little interesting. We're going to talk about the Ananda Marga organization, which appears basically to be in its elite manifestations, a fascist mind control cult. They have been accused of violence around the world and by many institutions, including even elements of CIA. They have been very active in India against the substantive communist community in India. And one of the influences on Sarkar was Subhas Chandra Bose. From the online book, the Google book, James R. Lewis, Violence and New Religious Movements, Sarkar was interested in the Indian struggle for home rule and had a maternal family tie to Indian independence fighter Netaji Subhas Chandra Bose, 1897 to 1945, or very possibly 1985, as we have seen, who was his maternal uncle. One of Sarkar's most important books on social philosophy, Problems of the Day, 1959, is dedicated to Subhas Chandra Bose with the following inscription: "To the great hero Subhas Chandra Bose, whom I did love and whom I do love even now," unquote. Like Bose, Sarkar was a believer in armed struggle, and he fashioned the ideology of his movement accordingly. More about Ananda Marga and Subhas Chandra Bose. Ananda Marga overlaps an organization called PROOT, capital P, capital R-O-O, all in capitals, P-R-O-U-T, which is a contraction of progressive utilization theory. And in one of their websites, what is the link between PROOT and Ananda Marga? In 1959, Sarkar, who was also known as Sri Sri Anandamurti, extended the scope of Ananda Marga philosophy to encompass certain socio-economic principles which had become known as PROOT, an acronym for Progressive Utilization Theory. This theory blends spiritual with socialistic idealism, a formula familiar in Eastern India, where prominent nationalists such as Vivekananda and Subhas Chandra Bose also made use of the present Ananda Marga slogan, liberation of self and service to humanity. The point being that Sarkar was not only a nephew of Subhas Chandra Bose, lived with him, which would have been during his Axis-affiliated period, admired him, and adopted his slogan, liberation of self and service to humanity. In our next show, we're going to go back and once again revisit AFA number 7 from the tail end of 1984, and two articles from the San Jose Mercury News about Ananda Marga, the San Jose Mercury of 8-15-82, both by Bernard Bauer, B-O-W-E-R. Among Ananda Marga, a deadly mix of yoga and violence, and cult guru inspires devotion, both about Ananda Marga, both by Bernard Bauer, both in the San Jose Mercury News of August 15th of 1982. I would note that in the general context of what we have been looking at, we have already seen Tulsi Gabbard, very close to Bernie Sanders, a member of the Hare Krishna cult, very close to the BJP, RSS, Narendra Modi, and that is basically the Hare Krishnas, or a fascist mind control cult, and we may very well be seeing something similar in connection with Ananda Marga. It is ostensibly a spiritual and yoga organization. I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing yoga as Nazi in any way. It is, from everything I can tell, has profound physiological and psychological benefits, and so I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing yoga as Nazi. However, we have also looked at Baba Ramdev in For the Record Program 1000, 18, 19, and 20. And his commercial herbs and foods organization, Patanjali, and his yoga practice as well. Baba Ramdev is very close to Narendra Modi and the BJP and the RSS as well. And we noted in that regard that, although again, I do not want to be misunderstood as characterizing yoga as Nazi, it does have, the history of yoga does have some overlap with Nazism, and I don't think it is a reach too much to ask the question, have some contemporary yoga organizations been seized upon by fascist and or Nazi slash underground like elements as vehicles for clandestine political activity? From the New York Times magazine about Baba Ramdev that we used in 2018, 19, and 20, from July 29th of 2017, I think this is actually 2018, Baba Ramdev's Holy War by Robert F. Worth. Yeah, it would have been July 29th of 2018, not 2019. This is a typo. Talking about yoga. Dozens of modern Ashtanga yoga postures are similar or identical to those founded by a gymnastic routine, those found in a gymnastic routine introduced to India by the British in the first decades of the 20th century, and originally developed by a Danish fitness instructor named Niels Buch, N-I-E-L-S-B-U-K-H, who later became notorious for his Nazi sympathies. From Niels Buch's Wikipedia page, his system of exercise became highly popular in Germany, and in 1933, Buch publicly expressed his allegiance to the National Socialist cause and its aim of improving the health of the Aryan race through gymnastics. This made Buch unpopular in Denmark. And, noting two articles, one from the Yoga Journal of February 24th of 2012, Nazi leaders fascinated by yoga, talking about the SS affiliation, or affinity, I should say, for yoga, and also a Daily Mail article from February 22nd of 2012 by Alan Hall. Daily Mail has a good old Daily Mail. We have ways of making you relax. How SS recommended yoga to death camp guards as a good way to de-stress. It, yoga, was seized upon by race experts in the party as being in the pursuit of Aryan, unquote, people. Jakob Wilhelm Hauer, an SS captain and yoga expert, who influenced his chief Himmler and convinced him that yoga can impermanently arm us and prepare us for the forthcoming battles. Himmler, obsessed as he was with hocus-pocus race theories and mysticism relating to his SS supermen, carried around a German copy of the Bhagavad Gita with him wherever he went. He regarded the ancient Sanskrit epic as being a blueprint for cruel and terror, using it, said Tietke, to ultimately justify the Holocaust. He wrote, quote, he identified himself and the SS with the old Indian Kshatriya caste and its publicized attitude of unscrupulous killing for one's higher purpose, unquote. And Himmler, again, and elements of the SS, saw yoga as a good way to relax, to further their aim, or to arm themselves. We talked about this in For the Record 1020. By the way, Subhas Chandra Bose also saw justification for his violent manifestations in the Bhagavad Gita. This is, again, by way of background to Sekhar Chakrabarty, the driving force behind AOC. He's highly educated. He sure as hell knows who Subhas Chandra Bose was, and he's not ignorant and would not be deceived. I think it is important and altogether revealing that he was manifesting his affinity for Subhas Chandra Bose. If he were what he would like to have us believe, he'd be manifesting Gandhi on a T-shirt, not Subhas Chandra Bose. More about Subhas Chandra Bose, Ananda Marga, and events taking place in 1945 in Asia in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1066, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, being recorded on March 26th of the year 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.